This is Julianne Lyon interviewing Professor Emeritus Susan Hockey for the Hidden Histories Project. It's the 21st of June at 10 a.m. and we're recording over the phone via Skype. So the first question that I'd like to ask, please, is to ask you to reflect on your earliest memories of encountering a computer or computing technology.
Yeah, well, I can tell you how I got started. I was an undergraduate in the late 1960s, and I did classical mods at Oxford, and then my final degree was in Egyptology. But I was always interested in language things. And I think it was about in 1967, I read those articles in the Observer from Andrew Morton, who'd been doing this text analysis study of the Pauline epistles with a computer. And it sounded really interesting, and I thought I'd like to work in something like that. So I set about trying to find out how I could do this. Because I was in an undergraduate in Oriental Studies, I met one of the lecturers in Arabic called Alan Jones and found out that he was already doing some computing things. I think my tutor told me about him, and I met him, and found out that he was doing some text analysis work on the Quran. And because technology within the universities at that time was quite small and very much focused on sciences, he was doing his work at an organization called the Atlas Lab, which was funded by what was then called the Science Research Council to provide computing support for universities, the things that the universities didn't have the technology to do themselves. And I applied for a job there, having no qualifications in computing, and my only mathematical expertise was up to O level. And they hired me. They took a chance, which was very, very nice, because I had no qualifications, and in fact they had to create a special job title for me because I didn't fit in the requirements for the Science Research Council, because they wanted someone who could be a focal point for these kinds of activities at the Atlas Lab. And it's been merged into many other things since then, but it's on the Harwell site at Chiltern. And they already had a concordance program called COCO, which was running on the Atlas was the first ever paged memory computing machine. It filled the whole room. And it was a British machine. I think they only built three of them, the Atlas 1 and about two or three other Atlas 2s. But they had several people using this COCO concordance program, which was written in, I think it was written in the Atlas machine language. And it had a really somewhat difficult user interface. I mean, you have to remember, this is the days when you put things into the computer on punch cards or paper tape, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And they wanted something that would have a slightly better user interface and something that would outlive Atlas. So they started a project to rewrite it, I think, in Fortran. I didn't actually do the coding, but I was a sort of advisor on that project. But the other thing they wanted was some means of generating output not in Latin characters. This was the days when you put uppercase letters into the computer and nothing else. And so I wrote some programs to display Alan Jones's Arabic concordances on a graph plotter, which is a really ancient device. It looked like it now, but it was the latest technology then and about the only way of drawing graphs. So I got interested doing that kind of thing, and there were several other people using the Atlas facilities, including, in fact, Andrew Morton, who was a terrific character and very entertaining to meet. So that's how I got started. At that time, it was entirely text analysis, because you couldn't put pictures, there's no way to put pictures in a computer.
Hello? Hello? Saying that Andrew Morton was a very entertaining guy,
yeah.
And that went off.
I think the next thing I went on to say was that at that time, because you could only really put capital letters and numbers into a computer, it was all sort of text analysis or number crunching. And I think the other thing then was, because there was so little disk storage, anything more than a very small file was stored on magnetic tape, which you can only access serially. So what you actually did with your data was rather dependent on that. You couldn't jump around in it, I think is what I'm trying to say. Because if you did, the tape had to wind backwards and forwards. And yep. There was very, very little remote access to computers. I mean, basically, you turned up with your decks of punch cards. So that's kind of how I got started. And I stayed there until, I think it was early 1975, when Oxford University decided they wanted to do something more on, literary and linguistic computing, computing in the arts it was called then, and they made, started looking for someone who could try to get people interested. So I applied for that job and got it. And it was, first of all, it was described as teaching officer for computing in the arts. And from I started giving courses there, and then we started developing more and different facilities. I don't know how much more you want on what I was doing there, which was I was there from 1975 till I went to America in 1991.
It's totally up to you in terms of it's what I'm really interested in is your reflection. So basically what interests you in terms of, you know, taking the interview in one direction or another.
Well, why don't we kind of stick to your questions at the moment, and then you could think of anything else that, you know, you want to take up.
Okay.
But I think I've sort of finished with more or less what I've got to say about question number one.
Yeah, your earliest memories, as it were. What about before you read that article by Andrew Morton in The Observer?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, I'd heard of computers because, you know, sometimes they got people's bills wrong. But I really didn't. I was interested, but I didn't know anything about them. So, there wasn't a lot of computing going on before then. I mean, some businesses had taken it up. And I'd read a few things about IBM. Before then, who were the main manufacturer in, or systems in business computing, but I wasn't so interested in the business world.
Yeah. Would you have heard of Boussa, for example?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Father Boussa. I don't think I'd heard of him until I started doing work in this area. And I started to dig around quite a bit. I mean, one thing at the Atlas Lab was quite generously funded, and they had a good library, which included the journal Computers and the Humanities right back to when it started, which was in 1966. So I spent quite a bit of time when I first got there rooting around in the library, and I found out about Father Boussa then and started following up about what he was doing. And I can't remember when I first met him. It might have been perhaps about 10 years later. I'm not sure. I remember him coming to Oxford and him coming to my office in Oxford. But that was probably in the late 1970s. But if he'd asked to come and see me, he'd obviously heard about what we were doing. But I know he spoke so many languages, but most of his operations were actually, you know, in Italian. But his English was pretty good. You know, he wrote the introduction to his St. Thomas Aquinas thing in Latin so that it could be read by lots of different people. But I don't remember in detail. I know I just read a lot of things about what was going on. And I went to the first conference in this country on what it's called literary and linguistic computing in 1970. And I know that Father Boussa wasn't there, but that's when I first met Antonio Zampoli. He was there. And quite a lot of other people. You know, and Antonio Zampoli started as Father Boussa's research assistant.
Yeah. Did you have when you became interested in computing, having just finished a degree in Egyptology with a specialization in Akkadian, was it?
Yeah.
Were you quite unusual among your classmates and other people in Oxford?
Well, to some extent. I mean, I think a few people applied for jobs with computing companies. Quite a few of my friends went into teaching, but there was a whole variety of things that they did. But, I mean, to some extent, but not seriously. I mean, I can remember going to the careers service in Oxford, which was, you know, nothing like the kind of thing it is now. And they were suggesting to everybody they should apply to the civil service or GCHQ or something like that. But they couldn't help me when I said what I was interested in doing. But I mean, people went to all kinds of different jobs, so I don't think it was particularly unusual. And I'm sure some of my contemporaries went to work in computing, but almost certainly in places like IBM or big computer companies. And some of them then ended up in university computing, but probably later on after that.
I wanted to ask you about the special job that was created for you in Atlas Lab, and I think you said it was there on the job that you were trained up in programming.
Well, they created a job and hired me. I wouldn't say it was created for me, but I was appointed to it. I was just given some books and said, read and get on with it. This is the way you learn Fortran, and if you need any help, come and ask. And that's how I learnt. And they were very, very helpful. And so I think I had one or two little tutorials with the head of one of the programming groups there. But basically, somebody explained to me how I got my punch cards done, like probably doing them myself, and what I had to do to hand in my punch cards to get my programs run. And I learned like that. And I'm still playing around with, doing things with computers quite a bit. I'm actually a great believer in reading manuals to get going, because you get a good overview of what's happening and an understanding of what you can and can't do. So I've almost entirely learnt that way. I think the first time I ever went to a computer course was when I was giving it. But I think a bit depends on the atmosphere I was in. I don't think I could have learnt like that if I was out on my own, you know, with a group of people who were not interested in it or not doing it. But there were lots of people around, and if you stuck, you just went and asked for help, and they would help you.
Okay.
So that's really how I learned.
And did it seem the first programming language you learned was Fortran?
And I learned some Algol, and I learned a little bit of Atlas Machine Code. And I started seriously doing Snowball when I wanted to give a programming course in Oxford, and it seemed the obvious thing for text handling. I think I looked at that a bit when I was at the Atlas Lab, but they didn't really have a proper compiler for it on the Atlas computer. But Fortran was the thing that everybody used for almost all the applications at the Atlas Lab.
When you started, I think, essentially teaching yourself Fortran, how did it compare with having spent 3 years learning Akkadian language?
Well, you know, I'm not the only person who said that computer programming is not dissimilar from Latin and languages like that. And when I first got started in this, at 30 years, I met a lot of people who'd got into it from classics, or who were classicists and took to programming very easily. And so I think there is a sort of kind of mental approach which makes the two somewhat similar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was always interested in the linguistic and the philological side of the languages that I studied.
And this was another language?
Yeah, it was another language, Latin. Yeah.
Another language.
And you couldn't break the rules in it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I had a question about how you first got involved in the literary and linguistic community, or literary and linguistic computing, whatever term we use it. But that was essentially through the Atlas Lab.
Yeah.
Was the Atlas Lab very much working in that sort of...
We went to... My immediate boss, but the person that I really did quite a bit of work there was called Bob Churchhouse, who actually then left there to take up a chair at Cardiff. But he and I went to the first literary and linguistic computing conference I think it was the first one in the UK, which was in Cambridge in the East of Acacia in 1970. And we gave a preliminary talk on what we were planning to do with all this non-standard character output. There were about 70 or 80 people there, and that's when I first met people who subsequently became quite well-known in the, well, were quite well-known in the field. I met Joe Rabin, for example, and Bob and Joe got on very well, so we all sort of kept in touch a lot. Because there was no email then, and so you had to rely on sort of putting a letter in the post or meeting people again at conferences. But this conference was such a success that they organised, another one was organised in Edinburgh 2 years later, and I think they carried on every 2 years for about 10 or 12 years. And more people kept coming, because they were, the proceedings were all published as real books. And so they, people got to find out quite a lot more about what was going on because of these books, because they were mostly they were published by well-known publishers. I think Roy Wisby edited the first one, which was published by Cambridge. And so there was a core of people that came every time. I expect that core was probably between, I don't know, 50 and 70 people, and others sort of dipped in and out. But that's how I sort of got involved more with the field. And I think, I'm just trying to remember what happened. That was before the Association for Literary and Linguistic Computing was founded. But there was a lady called Joan Smith who was in Manchester then, who was energetic, and she felt it would be a good idea to form a society to support all of this, and she was persuaded Roy, well, I think it was Roy Wisby, to take on doing this. And he, there was a meeting at King's College in London in 1973 when it was formed, and because I was there with a number of the other people from the Atlas Lab, and that's when it formed into a kind of society to support some of these things. And the society ran its own bulletin and journal for quite some time. But quite a few people came from outside the UK to that meeting. You must know Wilhelm Ott, who started computing quite a bit before I did. I mean, I first met him at his conference in Cambridge. He was there. Antonio Zampoli was there. A number of other people. And I don't know what's happened to it, but the ALLC had a book that used to go around for everyone to sign at meetings, annual general meetings, and that started at that conference. And I had it for a long time, then I passed it on to somebody else. I think Harold Short might have it. But that would be interesting to see, you know, if you're interested in who was there.
Yeah, I was going to, because I know that some of the archives for the ALLC membership are in King, so I was going to try to get access to them as well.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of stuff in there. I mean, I sent them some boxes of stuff, you know, a couple of years ago, but there's a lot more there. So it'd be good to have a look around that.
I should contact Harold about who would be the best person, do you think?
Probably Harold. Paul Spence, possibly.
Yeah.
I think he was the one that I can now remember boxing all this stuff up when we were clearing out a bit our place in Oxford. But that was just the remnants. It was mostly accounts and things like that.
Okay. Super. Mm. Okay, so that was how you got involved in the sort of, it's so difficult to know what where to choose the.
Well, more in the sort of community of doing this. I mean, I think I ended up on the committee of the ALLC fairly early on, and then I was editing the bulletin, and then I got elected to be the chair, which I actually did for quite a long time. And by then, various other international things have got going, like the TEI and other kind of more conferences and things like that.
And you were also very involved in TEI?
Yes, because that started with, the obvious reasons why people were interested in it, because they were fed up of not being able to use somebody else's text for a different application. And they were fed up of not being able to encode complicated things very well. And that's, the TEI started with a meeting which was organised by Nancy Ide at Vassar College in 1987, I think, November. And that was invitational. There were about 20 people there to try to get some idea of whether there was enough willingness amongst the community to do something about that and how such a project might be organised. And I think it was at that meeting that decided to organise it with two representatives from each of the three societies that were involved with it. There was the ALC, ACH, and the Association for Computational Linguistics, whose long-term secretary and general person who was doing things, Don Walker, had also realised that this was something important. And I was one of the two ALC representatives on the steering committee. And the other was Antonio Zampoli. We got some money from the National Endowment for the Humanities to get started, and Antonio was instrumental in helping us get some money from the European, some European funding commission stream, I don't remember exactly what. And there were six of us, I suppose, who organised it. And we took it in turns to chair the steering committee, and when it was ALRC's turn, it was me. And so we basically planned out how we were going to do this work and found some people to do some work and found some money to get it done. And we did get it done. And I know there's still a lot of interest in it, and the real issue later on was how to keep it funded. But we did get done more or less what we said we were going to do. And at the VASA meeting, I remember now, it finished up with a sort of discussion about what principles, what were going to be the basic principles for doing this project. And Nancy asked me to lead that discussion. And we, one of the earliest instances where I've ever seen something projected from a computer screen up onto a big screen, we sat for an afternoon and defined these things that became known as the Poughkeepsie principles. But you can find all that in the TEI archives.
Yes, it's available in the in the vault. That's really interesting, and that was the first time. So, and that was really cutting edge, I take it, at that point as well.
Yes, I mean, there was quite a lot of cutting edge about a lot of things that were going on, but I think we were all feeling our way, and we had some sort of intellectual goals that we wanted to meet, and it seemed the obvious thing was to try to use the technology to get there. And we said from the TI. Hello, you're still there?
Yeah.
They said from the TEI right from the beginning that anybody who wanted to work for it, do any work for it, had to do it by email. And it was, you know, not long after international email started, but we could see that was the only way we were going to get any work done. But then soon discovered that how difficult it is to get closure on an email discussion. And we did have funding to have face-to-face meetings, which really were very productive.
Mm. Sure. I served on the TEI Council a few years ago as well.
Oh, yeah, of course, I saw that, yeah. I think it's changed quite a bit since then, but, yeah.
But email is certainly still at the heart of all of us.
Yeah.
I'll just ask one or two questions, because we're talking about, say, 30, 40 minutes at this point, and it's, I know it can be sort of hard to be bombarded with all of these questions.
Sorry, I can't hear very well. Can you?
I'll just ask maybe two more questions, because I don't want to completely bombard you the first time.
No, well, that's fine.
We talk. Something that I wondered about just looking at some of the chronologies is that I noticed that the ACH, which I think you were also a founding member of.
Well, sort of, yeah.
But that was set up a couple of years after the ALRC?
I think it was later than that. It might have been perhaps 5 years after the ALRC. Joe Rabin was there. I can't remember. I don't know. Can't remember the details about founding the ACH, but they were certainly, Joe Rabin was interested in having some kind of society to support the Computers and Humanities Journal, which had been around various publishers. And I think also the Americans had sort of looked a little bit about what was going on in Britain, and they started a series of conferences in the alternate years. And the first one of those was at the University of Waterloo in 1977, and I remember that because it was the first time I ever went to North America. And that was similar in some ways and different from others, because there was a lot of interest in North America at that time about using computing to support all these courses they give to teach students how to write. And of course, we didn't have any of that in Britain. And so about half the papers there were about, you know, computing and composition, or I can't remember exactly what they call it. But they had, they started a series of conferences in odd numbered years to correspond with the European ones, which went on in even numbered years. And they were organized in a slightly different way, because conferences in America tend to be more condensed, more papers happening at the same time and fewer days. But I did go to quite a number of those as well. But I don't remember, I know I was a member of the ACH for quite some time, but I don't really remember exactly what happened about the organization of that. And it was run in a slightly different way from, you know, learned societies operate in a different way in Europe, well, in the UK certainly, I don't know about the rest of Europe, than they do in America.
Yeah.
So it was run in a more American style.
Okay. Okay, perfect. What about, sorry, I had a question about the people who influenced you and how and why they influenced
you. Yeah, I made some notes for you. I mean, I got a few down there. Father Boozer, because I think it's amazing that you start talking about the potential and the future of multimedia when you're nearly 90. And also, going back to what he did when he first started, you know, in the 1950s, he wanted to have a completely lemmatized version of his text. And we still can't do that really automatically now. I mean, things are a lot better than they used to be. But he didn't want to treat his text as just a sequence of letters. So I think what I learned from him was to keep looking ahead. And so I think, you know, he's been an enormous influence to all of us. Another one was Antonio Zampoli, because he also was thinking all the time about how we can do this better. Not just to do this particular project, but to think about how we can make it better, what better tools we can make for it. And he was very, very keen on linking up computers in, well, literary computing, if you like, as it used to be called, with research that was going on in computational linguistics. And there still aren't all that many people looking at that now. Maybe that, I mean, I'm not really up to date on what's going on now, but, you know, Greg Crane's group clearly are. But there must probably be some others as well. But Antonio was really keen, even in the 1980s, to do work, to try and apply the tools and techniques they developed for computational linguistics to see how well they worked with literary texts like Dante and other, you know, works of Italian literature. And also, I think one other thing I learned from him quite a bit was how to think about turning an idea of something you want to do into something that would be a project that was fundable. Because, I mean, there is a difference there. You can obviously have grand ideas, but you've got to, if you want some money to do something, you've got to think about what's practical and what bits of it, you know, can be done and how you're going to get the next bit of money to carry on after that. So that's another one. Two people who helped me a lot when I started were Bob Churchhouse and Alan Jones. I've already mentioned them. I have a couple of others, which are a little bit different again. David Barnard, who was involved in the TEI quite a bit when he was Professor of Computer Science at Queen's in Canada, he's now the president of the University of Manitoba. But he really taught me how to run a meeting. It was just amazing. And how to get things done, to scope out work. But he ran the best meetings I've ever been in by a long way.
Why were they so good?
Well, he just got through the business, decisions were made, and we were finished. I mean, he let people have their say, but then made sure that something was decided and minuted and carried on to the next thing. And there's one other person I wanted to mention, and this is a little bit different again, but there's always been a very, very friendly atmosphere amongst computing and the humanities, digital humanities, or whatever you want to say. And that goes back, I'm pretty certain, to the late Paul Fortier, who I remember talking to when he was at a conference in Edinburgh 1972, and he was in French studies, and he said the first conference he ever went to in French studies, nobody spoke to him, and he vowed it would never happen in computing in the humanities, and made a point of making sure that everybody spoke, new people got involved in the discussion and the social events, and that people spoke to them. And I think that's largely, well, one of the main reasons why there's always been such a friendly atmosphere. But that's a different thing again. But, I mean, that started a bit also, I think, from Bob Churchhouse, who was very sociable. But it helps a lot, you know, because new people come to a conference to learn, and they don't want to feel that they're just looking up to other people. I think it's nice to think that they feel on equal terms in many ways.
Do you think that the sort of social cohesion and kinship that exists in computers and the humanities, in addition to the shared intellectual goals and interests, do you think that, the field is somewhat unusual in that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never really been involved in other fields. I mean, another thing I wanted to say in relation to your question about what other humanities people think about it. I mean, for a very long time, I never came across them because I worked in a computing centre and you only saw the people who were interested. But I don't know. But I mean, I heard this a little bit from some other people. But I know, you know, we've always tried to be a sort of friendly and sociable group. And I think things have changed generally since the 1970s. But I think also in computing, you can realise there's a lot of the good work comes from the young people. You only have to look what's happening in the world of business computing and things like Facebook and Google and whatever.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to give them a chance to talk about what they're doing.
Okay. Definitely. Just talking a small bit more about that, what others' views may have been of the field, you didn't encounter that really.
Sorry, can you repeat the question here?
Just the question about how other scholars not using computing.
Yeah, well, I think I was lucky that I sort of didn't encounter it for a very, very long time, because at the Atlas Lab we met only people who were interested in using the computer. I was 16 years in the computing centre in Oxford. A good deal of that was before people had their own PCs, so they came to the computer centre if they wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And because humanities, at that time in Oxford, except for Oriental Studies, had no departmental facilities. I mean, you spoke to people who were in your college more than anything. And I was elected to a fellowship at St. Cross College in 1979, I think, which was one of the new young graduate colleges. And I met a lot of people from other disciplines there, but actually they were predominantly scientists and social scientists. There were very few humanities people there. But St. Cross was also very forward-looking, I think it was the first college to have a computer in Oxford. So I didn't really have any way of meeting people who weren't interested in computing because of where I was based and what I was doing. Occasionally I got invited to dinner in some other colleges by some of our computer users and got to talk to a few other people then. But I think people who weren't interested just sort of basically ignored it.
Yeah.
And I think I benefited, I mean, like I think a lot of the early work in computing humanities has from some interest from well-known scholars. And I was reading your other interviews, I think Harold mentioned that as well, particularly Anthony Kenny, who did various computer-based and stylistic studies based on concordances. So I got to know him very well. And I did quite a bit of work with Kenneth Dover as well, another very well-known classicist. And so I didn't really encounter that. And my next job in New Jersey was based in a library, and that was a different atmosphere. But I think, because I never worked in the library in the UK, I didn't really know what sort of atmosphere there was going to be. But I think it was still the time when electronic resources were rather strange things in libraries, and they tended to be treated as if they were another kind of book. You know, you make a catalogue record for it and stick it there for somebody to use, rather than sort of thinking about this is a very different kind of object and what are we going to do about it. But it was very, very early days for computing electronic resources in libraries anyway. They were almost all CD-ROMs. And so, I mean, there was quite a lot of interest there. But more in the way of how to treat this as something that librarians need to deal with. And I mean, that's still the case now, but I think it's rather different from when your electronic resources are just a lot of CD-ROM things. And they all have different software on them, so it's quite difficult for anybody to be able to support them because it takes so long to find out what you can actually do with it. So I think because I wasn't ever in a humanities department, certainly until I got to Alberta, where there was a very stimulating sort of intellectual atmosphere, I didn't really have much cause to be around people who weren't computing. And I think the same was true in Alberta. There was a very big project which I was extremely interested in, and I did quite a bit of work with, which was the Orlando project, and that was really pushing the boundaries of what you can do.
Mm.
And it generated, I think, quite a lot of intellectual discussion about the whole thing. And it got down to the bottom line is, how do you represent interpretation? And I think that was really the nuts and bolts of what was going on. And that generated a lot of interesting discussion.
Was Susan Brown involved in that project?
Sorry?
Was Susan Brown involved?
Yeah.
Yeah. How you represent interpretation is something that still hasn't been solved.
Well, exactly. But, you know, exactly.
Okay. That's brilliant. Okay, so the final question is about the participation of women in computing and the humanities, digital humanities, whatever we call it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't feel any problem of being a woman, and there were quite a number of women. I wouldn't say we were the majority, but it didn't seem to me to be a problem. I mean, I think one of the real things, certainly in the early computing and humanities computing, is everybody treated everybody else as equals because they were interested in what they were doing and then you knew they needed to learn something from them. And so I didn't find any problem in that. And I think there always have been quite a lot of women in computing right from the beginning. Now, I think there is perhaps a bit more of an issue of people who get into sort of management positions in universities in certain disciplines, but I don't know how much of that still holds true now. But I never found it, I never noticed it, shall I put it that way?
Mm.
And certainly when I got to work in libraries, and at UCL as well, of course, there's a predominance of women. And it was very obvious when I went to some big library conferences in America that the women were a big majority.
Mm. Yeah. For sure. Okay, well, thanks a million. That was really fascinating.
Good. Well, I'm really interested in this. Do sort of let me know if there's anything else you would like. You know,